and it's KVCR Arts Now on KVCR Arts and Entertainment, as well as the people and places providing it. I'm David Fleming. This is KVCR Arts number 650, and with that, welcoming Daniel Buxpan, author of Rush and 2112, 50 Years. Daniel, you've written many books in the music world, and you've done a lot of music-related blogs as well. But these books aren't just a gathering or restating of some of these blogs. They all started anew, right?
Oh, yeah. It started right from scratch. It's all original, new stuff at the time when I came up with it. You know, I mean, I've had blogs in the past and, you know, written other stuff in the past. I've even contributed reviews of Rush albums to other people's books. At first, I was sort of, you know, like, how am I going to come up with some completely brand new thing to say about Rush after I already did Rush at 50 2 years ago?
Yeah.
And it turned out that's no problem whatsoever. And I have such ridiculous fandom and enthusiasm for this band that they could probably give me 6 more books to do and it would be no problem.
Oh, I would say, I don't know if I should state this, the only Rush albums I really needed, like, I enjoy Fly By Night and, you know, some of the hits or whatever, but the only ones that I ever thought that I truly needed were Moving Pictures and 2112, and I was happy not having any others. Now, I may have read this somewhere, that this book, Rush and 2112, did this come directly from writing Rush at 50 with, you know, the realization that so much material on the subject, or perhaps it was the realization of a significant anniversary coming up, and that anniversary being 2026, maybe chicken or the egg thing there, but did the first book lead to this one directly?
Kind of. Rush at 50, I proposed to them, to the publisher, but this one was their idea, and they came back to me and they were like, do you want to do a standalone book about this album? And whatever they had asked me, do you want to do, you know, whatever about Rush, I would have said yes. But what was really interesting about it is most of the time, if you're going to do a standalone book about one Rush album, it's going to be Moving Pictures,
sure.
You know, because all the hits are on it and it's their biggest selling album and all of that.
Yeah.
2112 is a little less explored than Moving Pictures is. So there was a lot more I could get into that was maybe not as well known. You know, and also it's been longer. So there are more myths and legends about the album than there are about Moving Pictures. And what I always like to do as a writer, you know, and the number 50 appears in the title of a lot of my books, is a lot of time has passed now.
Yeah.
And there are all these myths and legends that have accumulated about this album. And so I like to go back and it's like, great, okay, 50 years later, is all of that actually true?
Mm-hmm.
Or is there more to it somehow? You know, and it's being not really in the moment anymore. And, you know, history has really spoken for this album. It doesn't need me to say anything about it. It stands alone. And, you know, like you said, for a lot of people, this album and Moving Pictures, and, you know, so it's established, it's known.
Yeah.
But for me, any historical event, like, you know, you could write a book about the Civil War and be like, well, was that true? Did this actually happen? Everyone thinks this happened, but did it?
Mm.
And I just always find that really interesting. And usually when you go back and look, there's always more to the story than people are saying. There's always some hidden wrinkle you didn't know about. And there were a few of those on this, and I was really happy for that.
Nice. Within this book, you have such an incredible collection of photos in the book, and I've never asked this before in all my interviews, but were there by chance any photos which inspired the writing of a chapter? Like, look at this photo. There's got to be a story behind, you know, whatever, Getty with a smirk on his face while Neil would be reading a book, et cetera, et cetera.
No, it's kind of a parallel process, sourcing the photos and doing the manuscript. And the photo editor, Stuart Pease, is really the guy responsible for all the photos that you see. He really understood what we were going for and what we wanted. So, you know, the photos that you see there, he really deserves credit for really understanding the assignment. And I should also give credit to my editor, Jordan Wickland, who found a lot of, like, neat little fan things and stuff like that to put in. So it was good because, you know, I could trust that they understood what I wanted, and that left me to just write this pretty heavy, involved manuscript. But, you know, I mean, they would show me what they were doing as it was coming along, and it was just amazing every time.
Oh, beautiful. And yeah. Were any of the photos by chance that you knew of or that they knew of something that they knew of as something which already existed that, you know, they just had to have for it? Then it was just a matter of tracking it down, or was it all, hey, they discovered it, let's see how it can work?
There was only one photo that I specifically asked for, and we could not get it, unfortunately. Ooh. There's one sidebar in the book about how 2112 is a punk rock album. Mm. And in fact, the best punk rock album of 1976, even better than the Ramones debut. Mm. Because even though they tuned their guitars and they can play and all of that, you know, the story of the album is that they were really sticking by their artistic integrity and what they really wanted to get across.
Yes.
And it was not what the label wanted. So in a lot of ways, there's very much, you know, kind of this defiant spirit to the record. So what I really wanted was a picture of the character Vivian from The Young Ones, a show you may remember.
Yes.
Yeah, who sometimes was seen in a Rush shirt from 2112. Yeah. I don't know if you remember that or not. It was only like a couple of times where I was like, we have to get that. We have to get that. But unfortunately, there wasn't, you know, a good close-up, wow, look at his shirt kind of a thing. But and we got something. There just wasn't like the perfect shot available, unfortunately. But, you know, that's how it goes.
That really is too funny. I want to swear that I remember seeing him in that shirt, but that may be a false memory there with kids in the hall. Anyway, you're listening to KVC Arts. I'm David Fleming in conversation with Daniel Buxpan about his newest book, Rush and 2112, 50 Years. Daniel, did this begin with a collection of writings and then you had to look for some sort of linear flow, or how did the organizational aspect of this happen?
I wrote it in order.
Ah.
Which sounds a little crazy because, yeah, you know, I think traditionally not everyone would necessarily approach it that way. I mean, I had all these ideas for things I wanted to put in the book. And the way it started to work is as I would go through it, you know, chronologically and everything, some of the ideas would get pushed to the back and more pushed to the back. And eventually I realized these ideas that I'm pushing to the back probably will not make it in. That's always the hard part, is not what to include. It's what to take out. You know, I mean, I had some neat things that would have been fun to do, but ultimately I felt like they didn't really serve the story. And I wanted the book to flow and be a very concise, tight read. And, you know, there's fun stuff at the end. You know, there's a restaurant named after the record, you know, but there's only so much of that that you want to put in before it just becomes like, hey, look at this thing. Look, hey, ha-ha. You lose the plot a little bit if you do too much of that.
Mm-hmm.
But I feel like we got what matters and we got what really should be in there.
Oh, nice. Are you prepared by chance to read a brief excerpt going into 2112 for Dummies?
So what the hell was the 2112 story about anyway? For those who never got to have Neil Peart explain it to us in person, it might be a little challenging to glean from the lyric sheet alone. You might guess it takes place in the future and is about an individual in an oppressive society, but the lyrics don't spell everything out explicitly. What was a fan who wanted a deeper understanding of the story to do?
That's a great little cliffhanger kind of thing, so we just heard from a bit of 2112 for Dummies, one of the chapter titles. I think these chapter titles are actually very much attention getters. This one gives us as far as familiarity, as far as titles go, but also here's a quick primer. Also, Neil's Neon Nightmare. Now, beyond my love for alliteration, this one I think especially an attention getter. From this section of the book, talk please about how the record executives were promised a record full of potential hits, and then they had to sit there for this 20-minute epic before even getting to singles.
Yeah, and there were no singles. They wanted that, and they asked for that, and the band even had their manager tell them, don't worry, guys, they're working on totally commercial music. It'll, you know, fit in right alongside the Bay City Rollers. There'll be no problem.
It's a Saturday.
And he hadn't heard it. He hadn't heard a note of it. So as far as he knew, he was telling the truth. But no, I mean, what's funny about it is this record starts with this very heavy conceptual 20-minute thing. And basically, that was the single. Because doing that and presenting the record the way that they did and all of it, is what opened the door for them, the way a single would traditionally. But that's just not who they were. And I think by, like, you know, really being themselves and really putting something out there that they believed in, I think that there's just something about the authenticity of it, I think, really resonated with people. And when you put this record on, the energy of it, the fury, all of it, yeah, just jumps off the vinyl at you. It gets your attention right from the beginning. And they recorded it thinking, you know, this might be it. You know, that we might not ever do another record after this one if it doesn't sell. But you can sort of feel all that emotion as you listen to it. You can sort of feel like, wow, they're just going for all the marbles on this one. They're putting all their chips on this. And to me, that's kind of part of why it gets across. You know, and Getty said something similar. It wasn't 50 years later, but someone asked him at least 20 years later, maybe, why are people still listening to this? Why is this still resonating? You know, he thought about it a little bit. And, you know, just one of the things was, I guess it just resonated. You know, the emotion and all of it that we were feeling, people who listened to it were able to latch on to that. It's there. And to me, that is so much of why we're talking right now about this record. I think if it hadn't had that, and if it had not been as original as it was, and if it had not also just totally rejected every single bit of conventional wisdom that the music industry has, it wouldn't be the same record. Even if it did have a hit single, I don't know if it would have gotten across.
It's interesting because they did this, you know, going against anything and everything conventional, but it still sounds great. It's not just I'm yelling and, you know, going against the idea of singing. And I mean, a phenomenal album. And it's funny, the record company did end up releasing a press kit, which I think you stated gave no indication of what they really thought of the album. And that's just funny. And people can read this in the book there. Something I thought of that you do include, but it led to another question for me. When Rush toured with Kiss so much between 74 and 76, you include that Gene Simmons called them, I think it was a Led Zeppelin Jr. or something to that effect, you know, referring to the power and feel and textures. And so I wonder, after 2112, have you ever by chance heard of Gene's judgment of something like, oh my God, this is more prog. I saw them as heavy, hard metal, rock, whatever. But now after 2112, he's like, wait, these Canadians, they're doing more prog or concept albums. Not that Gene would ever be judgmental.
No, of course not. you know, he'd be very guarded in his comments. Not want to hurt anybody's feelings, of course. No, he's always been very blunt to the present day that to him, Rush is that first record with John Rutsey.
Oh, wow. Nice.
Yeah, he referred to it as just, you know, the meat and potatoes stuff. You know, excellent. And when you listen to Kiss music, you can see why that is, and that he didn't care for it as much, like, as it got more progressive and getting into weird time signatures and stuff like that. It just wasn't for him. But he said they always just had this work ethic, and they just always brought just 100% all the time. And even when he didn't necessarily connect with the music they were making, you know, in a particular moment, it was always them. And they, as he said in the book, they were all for one and one for all. Even if you don't like their music, I think you have to admire that. And you have to really admire the focus that they had and the dedication that they had. There's just not a lot of that out there. And, you know, there are a lot of struggling musicians today who are sort of like, you know, what do I have to do to break through and become famous? And what I would recommend to them is do not read this book, because it will tell you all the wrong things about what to do to get famous.
Nice. I'm David Fleming in conversation with Daniel Buxban, with many books and blogs under his belt in the world of music, the latest being Rush 2112, 50 years. You can't fully talk about the book without, of course, talking about the album. On 2112, here, let's go into that a bit. In a nutshell, what we would normally call the title track, in this case for folks, is the entirety of side one. It's the title side, if you will, a story divided into seven movements. And then we have five more songs not related to the story on side one, which makes up side two. So here's a question, and it involves a brief sidetrack. The song Christmas Eve Sarajevo, this was amongst the biggest to come from Savatage, and without a doubt the beginning of Trans-Siberian Orchestra. But the thing is, when Paul O'Neill brought the tune to Al Petrelli as he was trying to work it out, Al said, and I quote, "Dude, what's with the Christmas song?" Okay. And then it was Al who actually really shaped the tune with the experience that he'd had while there when he was with Alice Cooper. So back to 2112, the suite, let's say. This was Neil Peart as far as songwriting. Do you know if there was any reaction, like, really? What's with this long sci-fi story? Or were Getty and Alex just as really amped, as it were, for this kind of thing?
They both said, and also Terry Brown, the co-producer, also said that, you know, when he presented the lyrics, they really kind of took a step back, like in a good way, in the sense that it was like, wow, this guy has just completely exceeded anything we could have expected for ourselves. Because, you know, it's this incredibly ambitious piece. And you have to keep in mind that, you know, at the time, the guys were not yet even 25 years old. You know, and they're still kind of unknown. It takes a lot of nerve as kind of a new unknown band. You know, it's basically like, this is our Lawrence of Arabia, our fourth record. But that's the thing, is they were up to the challenge. You know, we have seen so many bands try to do something ambitious, and, you know, for this reason or that reason, it doesn't work. This works. This absolutely works from start to finish. And you have to hand it to them for coming up with something like that. You know, especially at a time when they were maybe not in the best place with the label, coming out with something just incredibly ambitious, you know, that most bands who have been around for decades would not attempt. You know what I mean? Getting back to Kiss, They tried to do music from The Elder. You know, that was their attempt at being ambitious. I think we can all agree it did not do what they wanted it to do.
Right.
Although I love that record, and I will defend it until the day I die. But Rush can do that. For whatever reason, they're able to put these very high-level concepts into their music, but it doesn't in any way dilute the power of their sound. Like, that is still a very much a hard rock record.
Oh, yeah.
It gets called a prog record. I don't really think it is. I think that's a hard rock record that does prog things, maybe a better way to say it.
Sure.
If you just want, like, you know, some, you know, good hard rock to just jam out to, that record is great. It will work. Or if you want something at this much higher level, it functions that way too. And I would say that about pretty much their entire catalog. You can just bang your head to it if you want, or you can really dig into it on a much deeper level.
Yes, and even some of the songs from the elusive side too that start off very much acoustic lessons, Something for Nothing, for example. These are, you know, it's still, then they really, really rock out after that. The cover art for 2112, this ended up becoming the symbol of the band. Break that cover down, if you will, the artist they used, and then the piece itself. I mean, in a way, a person could look at it and say it's kind of basic on the surface, but I really feel like there's a lot more depth in thought involved.
Yeah, it was their second time working with Hugh Sine. Their first experience with him was for the cover to Caressive Steel, which the people at Mercury didn't like it, and they just unilaterally stepped in and changed the cover. Yeah, so when the record shipped, it was this thing that just had nothing to do with what Sine had designed, and they really didn't like it. So they had it written into their contract that any time the record was going to go to press, Hugh had to be there to personally approve what they were about to print. You can see that as also kind of like an early sign of, oh, these guys know what they want to do, and they're not going to really accept any interference. They really have their vision, and they really want to pursue that. Hugh, who I interviewed for the book, he told me that the design of the 2112 cover just came from talking with Neil about the lyrics and what it was all about, and just what he did seemed to be a, you know, a good approximation of the theme of the story. He did not know, and nobody knew at the time, that it was going to become what he called their Playboy Bunny.
You're
or,
right,
you know, the Mick Jagger lips and tongue.
That's right, Stone. Yeah.
yeah, it just turned into this incredibly iconic, easily identifiable thing. And, you know, what you said about it being, you know, a simple design, I think that's actually why it works, you know, because you can really make a very strong impression with a simple design. And, you know, I mean, I don't know if it was the same for you, but that record, you could walk into the record store and that record could be on a rack all the way at the back of the store and you would see it when you came in. You could see it from that far away. And it just attracts your eye and is just very pleasing to the eye, but it doesn't give everything away. So it makes you curious about, like, ooh, what's in here? What's in this record with this interesting cover? What's that all about?
Yeah.
You know, and I mean, 50 years later, again, here we are talking about it. So I guess it worked.
It's very intriguing. And it was a very, I think, interesting notion in being inspired by the lyrics, but wanting to make sure to not be too precise or literal. Although, as you stated in the book, or what he stated and you included in your book, some dude, in their words, tuning a guitar atop a spiral staircase, really, I think, could have been quite nice. Do you know if there was any discussion of the art, or they asked for something and they got this guy in a pentacle and they went with it?
There was no pushback whatsoever. They nice. Just, they felt like, yep, that's it. You got it. But
oh,
again, not thinking, okay, we're set for the next 50 years.
Right,
just
right.
This will be good for this record. And I think anyone you talk to who's had some work of art that they've done, some creative effort that they've done that has ended up just staying out there and just resonating for years, people will always ask them, you know, did you know when you made it that it would turn out this way? And, you know, they've all said, we had no idea, you know, creatively, we were just kind of fighting for our careers on this record. And that cover, Hugh was like, yeah, it's an elegant design and, you know, it's very easy to see and very pleasing to the eye. But at no time did they ever think people will talk about this in the year 2026.
Yeah,
it just
right.
never came up.
I'm David Fleming in conversation with Daniel Buxpan. His latest book is Rush 2112, 50 Years. This is an iconic album, and despite its popularity, it's known mainly for the title track, which again takes up the entirety of side one, although there's so much more there. Let's talk about that lost second side. I'm being only a bit tongue-in-cheek in that, yeah. I think a lot of the time when people think about and play 2112, they're really thinking about side one when they're wanting to hear 2112. But there are things like Passage to Bangkok and just all these other really cool tunes that don't necessarily tie in. I say necessarily because I really feel like Something for Nothing could tie in, but we may circle
right.
back to that. But I don't know if I'd noticed this on other Rush albums. It was Neil doing most of the writing for this, as far as lyrics anyway. We've got Lifeson and Geddy Lee each taking a turn on Lessons and Tears.
Yeah.
Was Neil the primary lyricist?
Like 90% of the time, I would say it was him. You know, he was not on the first record, and those lyrics were done at the absolute last minute by Geddy and Alex. And if you take that record, read the lyric sheet, and then go to Fly By Night and read the lyric sheet, you will say, oh, something is different here. It just kind of fell into place that he became the lyricist, you know, because Geddy and Alex just didn't really like to write lyrics that much.
Okay.
It just wasn't really their thing. And what Neil said was he noticed a vacuum. You know, there was just an opportunity there. So he just wrote some lyrics and presented them, and they used them. And that's just how he became the primary lyricist. It just worked.
Okay.
And there was no fighting about it. And there was no, like, but, you know, this is my song. There's just none of that. I mean, also just having a drummer write lyrics is
yeah.
just really unusual. This is, you rarely see that. But I think that helps also incorporate the drummer into sort of like the front of house of the music. You know, the drummer is always at the back and sometimes can be a little on the outside of the band socially and musically. But he was really involved, like, right at the forefront. To me, that's why those lyrics are just so easily identifiable as him and as Rush lyrics. And when you go through their catalog, you know, read all these lyrics, no one else writes like that. He's the only guy I can think of. They were just lucky it worked out that way, I think.
I think just a nice way to wrap here. This isn't a great spoiler alert here, but talking about the way the book ends, you're circling back to memories of the album. Alex, for example, you know, putting on the album every so often and being rewarded by the experience. Much like musicians creating an album when they have a pile of songs and they choose one with which to close, and then sometimes it's a matter of having the album together and then wanting to write a good closer. Did you by chance already have this portion together and decide, wait, okay, this is going to be a great ending, and then you ended up placing it last? Or was it a case of having the book and then needing to write a good closer?
No, it kind of presented itself. There are a lot of similarities where, you know, this album, everything kind of fell into place for them. Mm-hmm. And for this book, everything just kind of fell into place for me. And there were just a lot of very natural quotes and stuff like that that I saw that just really served the project very well. And, you know, when I saw that, and there's, I think, a closing comment from Terry Brown, they remember it so fondly. A lot of musicians never listen to their own record. Some of them hate the sound of their own records. But, you know, the fact that Alex will put it on sometimes and be like, yeah, all right, we had something here. To me, that really speaks very well of the album. I mean, I don't read my books after they come out. You know, okay. I wrote it already. I'm done with it. You know? But yeah, I mean, to be able to go back in middle age, you know, and revisit something you did when you were in your early 20s and not cringe, that's amazing. That really says a lot about, you know, how well the album holds up. If the artist can listen to it, it's a good album, I think.
Oh, wow.
Usually they're like, oh, it's terrible. I hate the way it sounds. Our producer was stupid. And, you know, it's all this stuff. It is rare that they will go back and listen to it. But here we are.
It's been a conversation with Daniel Buxpan for this edition of KVC Arts. Daniel's authored quite a few books in the world of music, with his latest being Rush 2112. 50 years. More at notoriousbuk.com. And with that, we wrap up another edition of KVC Arts. Thanks again to Daniel, and here at KVCR, thanks to Rick Dulock, Sandy Hodela, Jessica Greenwell, Tony Lopez, and Shireen Awad. Many past shows can be found through iTunes, Spotify, NPR One, or many other podcast sites, and more still at kvcr.org/arts. Music beds and themes heard on KVCR is composed and performed by Sean Longstreet, so thanks to Sean as well. It's been Rush 2112 through and through this time around. Also, this edition of KVC Arts goes out to Kevin Wolf, with whom I have a few very specific Rush-related memories. I'm David Fleming. Thanks especially to you for listening and for your support. It takes only about 3 minutes of your time to support KVCR with a financial contribution. It's a 3-minute investment of your time, with the return being the programming you value and count on being there for you the rest of the year. It really is a sound investment. Yes, pun intended. Again, whether it's a one-time gift or if you're setting up a sustaining membership with an automatic monthly contribution of $5 or $10 or more, it's just 3 minutes of your time. Go to kvcr.org/support. And again, thank you so much.